that how we treat our watershed determines the quality of water for all of us. For more information, log on to anythinggoesradio.com. Small changes can reap big changes for our environment. This commercial with a conscience message is brought to you by Bastet Productions, LLC.
Hello, this is Marvin Hamlisch, and you're listening to Anything Goes with Lise Avery. Good stuff.
And it's 10:16 in the morning on this gorgeous, gorgeous Monday, the 19th of April. We're celebrating Earth Day today here on Anything Goes. Earth Day is officially Thursday, but, we're here on Mondays, and so why not get an early start? And if you were with us for the 9 o'clock hour, you know that we have many trivia questions and lots of tips and tricks on things that you can change in your life, little things that can make a big difference for the environment, and we're giving away a lot of booty in exchange for your wisdom, namely Anything Goes organic cotton tote bags. I got some books for you and all sorts of stuff, and I've been promising you a very special guest, and let me tell you, just about to be on the wire with Dr. Gray Miriam, and he is a landscape ecologist, and Aileen Miriam, a horticulturist and environmentalist. Gray Miriam, he's retired now, but he's still a practitioner, serving many in groups who apply landscape ecology. Gray did a research project at the University of Texas, and he was following snow tracks of woodchucks after they emerged from hibernation, and that led to inventing radiotelemetry. Now, I've got to, I gotta tell you that I've been defining that for you all day, but I don't think it had a name when Gray invented radio telemetry. So we'll have to ask him about that, because he wanted to not just track the animals in the snow, but he wanted to know much more. So he improved tracking, or improved the tracking of the movements of the animal with radio telemetry. And then later, he and his grad students showed that landscapes are all connected in ways that impact the animals and their lifestyles, and in ways that nobody had ever really thought of before. As a consequence of that work, Gray was chosen president of the International Association of Landscape Ecology and was invited to teach grad courses for the Nordic Council on Ecology. And the thing to keep in mind is that this work led to lots of changes in the way that building happens in the U.S. and across the world, and probably not enough as far as Gray's concerned. But I want to remind you that Gray Miriam is joined today with his partner, horticulturist and environmental advocate, Aileen Miriam. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
Morning, Liz.
There she is. Yeah, Gray, the last line of this bio you sent me, it says you have stopped flying around and you live quietly with your partner Aileen on the Salmon River in Eastern Ontario. When did that start, the quiet part?
We're working on it as a current project.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
As long as we can hear the river running past the door, we know we're okay.
Okay, there you go. If you guys are a regular listeners of Anything Goes, you know that I head on to Canada on as frequently as I can to my cottage, which is on the Salmon River, at the head of the Salmon River in Ontario. And that's how I met Gray and Aileen. And it wasn't until last year, I've known you guys now for, it's about 7 years, you guys. And it didn't even occur to me to ask you these questions, so I'm glad to be doing it on the air. So, Gray, the first thought that you had, now you were an undergrad student when you thought about tracking woodchucks?
I was tracking them in Ontario.
Uh-huh.
And the only way you could track them, of course, was during the early spring when they're coming out of hibernation.
Uh-huh.
And you could follow them in the snow. The alternative at that time to learning about movements was to get them into a live trap and then put a little tag in their ear and try to get them to come back into the live trap sometime later. And you sort of guessed at where they had been between those two times.
I don't understand. What did the tag have that gave you that?
It just had their serial number, their name, if you like. So you could tell that you
Okay.
Joe back again.
Okay.
Joe was in a different place, but you had no idea where Joe had gone between those two sightings. That was a little bit unsatisfactory. I was looking for little more information about the continuity of what they were doing when I wasn't able to see them.
So really, I mean, when we think of tagging, of course, we're living in the world of GPS and everything. Essentially, you just identified the animal with some kind of a name or a color, and that way you knew you had the same animal, and that's essentially what the tag was.
It was, yeah. Okay.
And could
we actually borrowed the tags from people who put them on fish, and they Monel metal tag with a number.
Okay, and what would you do when you got the animal back in the trap? Would you test its paws for soil samples? Or, I mean, I don't understand what information you could glean by trapping an animal that you had had before without...
Well, if I caught Joe the woodchuck the first time on Jim Green's farm and the second time on Susie Brown's farm.
Oh, okay.
Then Joe must have gone between those two places, but I don't have any idea whether he took a bus or hitchhiked.
He was hitchhiking on an antelope. So the next step was what, Gray? I mean, obviously the next step is, tell me if I'm pronouncing this correctly, it's radio telemetry, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so, but you invented that, but that's not what you were thinking of inventing when you invented it, right? You were just there's got to be something better.
It came to pass because I was looking for some way to get more information. The reason that I wanted to get more detailed information was that there seemed to be some social groupings among woodchucks. That is, the ones on one hill did not necessarily go over to visit the ones on the hill next door.
Oh, and wow.
There was no reason you could see on the landscape why they were not doing that, but there was evidence from work that had been done with prairie dogs that the same thing happened there. They organized themselves into little social subgroups, and I wanted to learn a little bit more about that, and fortunately, I spent one Christmas time at Cornell, and a friend of mine, Charlie Walcott, made the offhanded remark that this would be really easy if they each had a little radio and were transmitting to you. And he didn't realize how naive I was. I took it seriously and went ahead and found a way to do it.
Hey, Gray, why don't you give me to walkie-talkie? Then they can tell you.
Yeah.
All right, so then... Aileen, you were a part of this as well. So Gray came home with this harebrained idea. It was pretty harebrained at the time, right? So how did you guys, how did this happen? How did it come to pass? And, you know, bearing in mind that we don't know anything about what it's like to be a landscape ecologist or a horticulturist in the late 50s.
Oh, my.
Come on. You know this.
Well, I'm not sure how it began. Like, I know that they were discussing for quite a while how on earth they could do this, because it's not possible to put a collar around the neck of a woodchuck. They would just shuck it off.
Okay.
And so they decided to make a little capsule. Gray could describe it better than I can, but it had a transistor in it and a battery, and I think because of the batteries of the day, it was bigger than it would need to be today.
Okay. Can you speak up just a little, Aileen? Because we're losing some of your words. So a woodchuck, you can't put a collar on it just because of its physiology, essentially,
because
right?
Because of its shape.
Yeah, so because it can't...
It doesn't have a neck.
Its head is not bigger than its neck, right? That's really the problem. That's why it can
That's
just sort of push it right off, okay? So just in case those of us who are not picturing woodchucks understand what that was. So it was you had to make the transmitter unusually large, Gray. How was it? How big was it?
It was a very big and a very long thumb. So it was quite large.
Big
compared to what's available these days. When we were doing this, it was at the time when the very first transistor was available on the market. There was only one type of transistor available.
Uh-huh.
And that transistor was as big as the end of your little finger. And the batteries were huge in those days, so the whole transmitter came out to be a very large man's thumb size.
Okay, all right then.
And we didn't know exactly what to do with that on a woodchuck except to insert it surgically. So we did. We we constructed a woodchuck outpost surgery by borrowing a shack from the guys working the plot next door in the dead of night and made that into our surgery, and we put the transmitters under the skin of the woodchuck on the back of their neck.
Uh-huh.
And Aileen and I were the total staff in our surgery, which was supplied by power line coming through the trees and a garden hose snaking along the ground. It was a very upscale surgery.
Oh, and you're tuned into Anything Goes on member-supported WFDU-FM. I'm Lise Avery. I'm speaking with landscape ecologist Gray Miriam and horticulturist Aileen Miriam about the very first time anybody put a transmitter on an animal. And Gray, you put it in the back of the neck. That's really still the location where a tracking device is placed on an animal, right? I guess because it's the most difficult for them to mess with back there.
In most cases these days, the transmitters are put on the outside rather than on the inside, except possibly for snakes. Most of the transmitters are attached on collars.
But so it's on the back of the neck, though, right?
Well,
most of the time
it varies. If it's something like a caribou, then it's just a big collar with a transmitter on it, and it rotates around and hangs at the bottom of the collar.
Okay.
No. It becomes more difficult when you're putting transmitters on very small things like birds and bats, and you have to be more careful where you put it, and you have to be careful that you don't interrupt their aerodynamics and cause them to prang into buildings and trees. So it depends on, you have to learn something about the animal and its habits. In the case of the woodchucks, what I did was dig a big hole in the ground at Cornell and dug it down 4 feet deep, lined it with electric weld wire and brought that up and made cages on the top and then put the dirt back. And I trapped an unaffected animal and put him in there as the digger, and he dug burrows. And I gave him a furlough, and I put the experimental animals in there. We put a dummy capsule in surgically, put the animal into this caged burrow, and I was able to climb up in a tree with my binoculars and watch the behavior of the animal to make sure that what we've done to it did not affect its ability to dig and go down the burrow and things like that.
And Aileen, I'm trying to remember, because we were sitting on your back deck when you first told me this story, but I want everybody to keep in mind that when this was done, the year that this was done, I mean, we're so used to radio signals flying through the air and telephone signals, but you guys had to run spools and spools of wire to track the woodchucks, right? Can you tell me how that worked?
Yes, we had... I don't know the electronics that well, but we had to take a wire from the shack that was the surgery and also where the information came in. We had to run a wire out to each and every woodchuck burrow, make a loop around the burrow, and then bring the wire back to the shack. So each burrow had all of these wires. We had spools of surplus wire, and I can remember distinctly helping to carry them on a broomstick. Peel them out across the landscape.
Like the little milkmaid.
Yeah.
That's absolutely amazing. So you had to use spools and spools of wire and wrap the wire around the different burrows in order to grab the signals from the radio transmitters that were on each individual animal.
Yes.
Is that right?
There was a machine developed pick up the signals and record them.
We worked with a man in Philadelphia, a man named John Busser, who was with American Electronics Limited, and he produced an electronic machine that would switch from one burrow to the next in a constant rotation and listen at each burrow, and if there was an animal there with a transmitter, it would read the frequency of that transmitter, which was the animal's identity, and record that. And in those days, as I said, there were no transistors commonly, so our big machine was a wonderful display of vacuum tubes that all lit up and blinked in the dark. And the way we recorded the data was also similarly primitive. We used a 1-inch wide paper tape that we punched holes in 8 channels. So we had this punch that listened to the machine and said, that's Woodchuck 132 and he's in burrow 8, and punched that information out with the time and the date on this long roll of oiled paper tape.
Amazing.
And then the paper tape had to be fed into a teletype machine, and the teletype machine read the holes and typed out for us long strings of data about where each woodchuck was.
Do you have pictures of this gizmo? Not for nothing? Gray and Aileen Miriam, do you have pictures?
Oh, boy. I don't recall that.
Okay, I'm just curious. That was just me. That Miss Avery is over here. That was me asking.
I wouldn't mind having one. One thing I remember is when the machine came, which was one of a kind, and it came with its own typewritten instructions manual. And the very first instruction said, turn the on-off switch to on.
That's good. It's like the directions on a can of Campbell's soup. Open
good
can.
Good thing we could read.
Yeah, there you go. And you're tuned into Anything Goes on member-supported WFDU-FM. We're having an Earth Day celebration today. I'm Lise Avery. I'm speaking with landscape ecologist Gray Miriam and horticulturist Aileen Miriam about, the first time anybody put a tracking device on an animal. In their case, it was a woodchuck. We're going to take a quick break in a minute, Gray, but can you tell us quickly, I know quickly is tough with all of this information, but what were you trying to learn by tracking the woodchucks?
I was trying to test the hypothesis that they set up social subgroups among the woodchucks on a farm. There were social groups that would be analogous to community groups in human social structure.
Okay.
And I was trying to test that by seeing whether the movements of the woodchucks were restricted across invisible boundaries in the landscape.
Wow, that's fascinating. And when you were doing this research, now we know you're Canadian, but you were in Texas, is that right?
No, at Cornell.
You were at Cornell when you did this, okay.
They didn't have enough snow in Texas.
I'll get you for that a little bit later, Gray. We'll have more with Gray and Aileen Miriam just after this quick environmental quick tip on this Earth Day special here on Anything Goes. Hang out, you guys. I'll be back in a minute. This is Lise Avery with more simple ways you can change the world. Did you know that you have a carbon footprint? We all have one, and the size of our carbon footprint tells us the amount of greenhouse gases we create, directly or indirectly, by our activities and our choices. In other words, when you drive a car, heat your home, or buy food or anything else that was manufactured or transported, you generate CO2, which contributes to your carbon footprint, and that may contribute to global warming. Making small changes in your home and habits can give you a much smaller carbon footprint and save you money, too. We'll have more about that the next time. For more information about carbon footprints and for a calculator to determine yours, log on to anythinggoesradio.com and look in my green links or check out epa.gov. Small changes can reap big rewards for our environment. This commercial with a conscience message is brought to you by Bastet Productions, LLC.
Hi, this is Davy Jones, and you're listening to one of the coolest mixes of music I've ever heard. Anything Goes with Lise Avery.
And Davy lives on a farm in Pennsylvania. He's living out in the country, too. And it's 10:35 in the morning on this gorgeous Monday, the 19th of April. We're celebrating Earth Day here on Anything Goes today. And Earth Day is this Thursday, but we got Monday, so it's all good. And I'm on the phone right now with landscape ecologist Gray Miriam and his partner in crime and horticulturist, Aileen Miriam. And Gray, can you just give us a little bit of information about corridors for animals and how we can actually think about that in terms of when we look at a landscape, we see it all of a piece, you guys. How does an animal see it?
I think when animals look at it, they look at it just like you look at a shopping mall. It's an aggregate of a bunch of places that have, each one has different resources that you might want.
Huh.
And you have a certain amount of time, and you have seasonally changing needs, and you have to go to the right stores to get the right resources in order to survive. So you become required to move through this mosaic and to move effectively to those places that can give you the resources that will let you and your offspring make it through the winter and into the next year. So I think animals see a landscape as a mosaic, which has in each one of its patches the possibility of valuable resources and also the possibility of trouble. And you have to move through that mosaic, and you're essentially solving a system of equations of your needs and the resource supplies that can be used to fill those needs, and that keeps changing as you go through the seasons. So you can think of woodchucks or mice as sitting at their PCs, working their way through these complex equations that result in success or failure.
But what about if somebody builds a 6-lane highway across my shopping mall, Gray Miriam?
That's trouble.
Then you have two options. One is you stay back from the highway, and the other is you get smushed by a truck.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing those very vivid images. But the point is that
it's fragmentation.
From your work and the work of subsequent landscape ecologists, there are some places that are employing some wisdom about how an animal sees a landscape, and either choosing the location of the roadways or creating corridors, right, Gray?
That's correct.
How do they do that?
It's even more fine-grained than having to put a big throughway through. All you have to do is put a farmer in there and let him remove the forest and turn it into a cornfield, and that can be an effective barrier to lots of animals as well. So it becomes a question of fragmenting that mosaic that the animals have learned to survive in over time and changing it so that they can no longer move through it. And it turns out that if you use digital models, you can show that their ability to move through that mosaic is more effective in giving them survival than their ability to increase their number of offspring.
Wow. That's huge. So what you're saying is that our intervention makes a humongous difference in the survival of a group of animals or even a species based upon the choices that we make in things that we construct or even fences that are put up or if we buy a vacation home or that kind of thing. The kind of choices that we make can really make a difference, long term and short.
It's very important, and the trick is that the animals rely on adaptation over time, and their adaptation takes a lot of time, but we can put a change into the environment at a rate that they simply cannot match. So they cannot change their way of living as fast as we can change the space we ask them to live in. And that's what catches them out.
Wow. Now, we're going to run out of time, but I want to let everybody know, if you just joined us, you're tuned in to Anything Goes on member-supported WFDU-FM. I'm Lise Avery. We're celebrating Earth Day here on Anything Goes today, and our special guests are landscape ecologist Gray Miriam and horticulturist and environmentalist Aileen Miriam. And I don't want to let you guys go until without talking about, Gray, you have a book out called Discovering Natural Processes, which talks about the interconnectedness of all living things. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It was an attempt to try to get rid of all the complications that usually arise when you think about environmental relationships and boil it down to a small number of really fundamental processes. And by fundamental processes, I mean, for example, the most basic requirement for all life is that we have green plants that can capture energy from the sun. Without them, there's no energy available for any of the rest of us that are freeloaders that don't have green leaves.
You mean like oxygen and decomposition?
Just the energy is the simplest way to look at it.
Huh.
There simply is not any food energy available that did not come to you from a green plant.
Huh.
And the second most important process is to recycle that organic material. Dead leaves and other such things are broken down by decay processes, and that recycles the nutrients back into the system, and you recharge them with another load of sunlight and run it through again. And those are very fundamental processes that we should think about when we're trying to figure out how best to fit our lives in with the lives of all the other living things.
Right. Well, this is, you just said something really eloquent, Gray, and that is that I think man, or many, or much of mankind is guilty of just doing whatever it wants and hoping that nature will fall in line behind whatever we feel like doing. And I think the new belief system, certainly mine, and I know yours and many people out there, is about fitting our lifestyles around the needs of the planet and the nature. And that we can do quite well just thinking about it and making small changes so that we have a smaller carbon footprint and we have less impact on the landscape and the environment. We can get that book from you, right? The Discovering Natural Processes. I've linked your face, Gray, your picture, on my website to your email. So if you guys, if you have a question for Gray or if you'd like to get yourself a copy of Discovering Natural Processes so you can learn more about the interconnectedness of all living things, just shoot Gray an email. Or if you have a very special question you want to ask him about this journey that we haven't had time to speak about here on Anything Goes Again, all you have to do is log on to anythinggoesradio.com, look for Gray Miriam right there in my interview gallery, and click on him, and you'll get an email address that you can shoot right to him and get a copy of Discovering Natural Processes, etc., etc. Gray, we're running out of time. Aileen, do you guys have anything else you would like to add? Anything you'd like everybody to take away on this Earth Day week?
I would say one of the things people should be looking for at this time of year are all of the beautiful native wildflowers that are out there. We spend a lot of time buying horticultural products and ignoring the beauty that's out there everywhere.
So essentially you're saying we can also plant things that are native and be aware of what's native to our environment and appreciate what's there, Aileen?
Yes, and also to be very careful not to plant things that are introduced and invasive, because mm-hmm. they can take over the space that the native plants grow in.
So be aware of what's native to your area. And we have lots of beautiful stuff here in New Jersey, the Garden State, that is native. But it's true. Once you start something invasive going, like purple loosestrife, right, Aileen?
Yes, and I'm thinking of garlic mustard is a big problem right now.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
This time of year is the very best time to get out into the woodlands and see what beautiful native plants are there now.
And do you have any tips for us, Aileen, when we're going to the garden center as to what we should choose and what maybe we should leave behind?
There are lots of good websites. I don't have any at the tip of my finger, but there are lots of websites where people can check and see.
Okay.
And if you're buying native plants, you should check and make sure that they're not, that they've been grown from seed or propagated otherwise and not dug from the wild.
An interesting point. So that essentially that it's not being harvested from leaving some woodland barren, but that it's something that is being grown
That's correct.
And propagate it. All right, you guys. Well, I wish we had more time to spend, but our time is up. And again, Anything Goes listeners, if you would like more information about Discovering Natural Processes, which is a wonderful book about the interconnectedness of all living things, well, you can always shoot me an email because I can get to Gray in more ways than he likes to admit, info@anythinggoesradio.com, or get to me through my website. But you can get directly to Gray Miriam by clicking on his picture on my website right there on the homepage at anythinggoesradio.com. Thanks so much for making time for us today, you guys, and thanks for the education. And see you around the end of the month.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Have a good day.
Bye for now.
All righty. And right now, I think we'll bring in a big yellow taxi to put the cherry on the point.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people $1.50 just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
10:48 is the time, and next week here on Anything Goes, all Ella, all Duke, all the time, in honor of their birthdays. That, of course, was Joni Mitchell and Big Yellow Taxi for your Earth Day celebration here on Anything Goes. I'm Lise Avery. Don't forget, you can get linked to Gray Miriam by clicking on his photo on my homepage at anythinggoesradio.com. Meantime, we will be giving you a chance to win tickets to Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola at Jazz at Lincoln Center, as usual, any minute now. But right now, since I've evoked Ella Fitzgerald's name, well, kind of like potato chips. One Ella's never enough.